On St. Patrick's Day, Wisconsin's Public Service Commission voted unanimously to allow Madison Gas and Electric, We Energies, and Wisconsin Public Service Electric Company to spend $433 million to acquire a 200-megawatt solar power plant that a Chicago-based developer is building in the town of Paris in Kenosha County. It's the morning show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And this plant will also include enough battery capacity to store 110 megawatts of electricity. When completed, it will be the first of its kind in Wisconsin. So what do you want to know about the technology, the likely costs, and potential benefits of this new power plant? Join the conversation at 1-800-642-1234. Email available to you this morning, ideas@WPR.org. Our guest, Catherine Blunt. She's the renewable energy and utilities reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Catherine, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with this 110-megawatt battery pack. Put that number into some perspective for us, Catherine. How does the size of the park, this pack, compare to other storage facilities across the country?
Yeah, you know, I'm not intimately familiar with this project, but that seems fairly substantial to me. And solar plus storage projects are becoming more common across the United States, and there's a couple of reasons for that. For one, of course, to add storage capacity to a project like this means that it really just increases the utility of the project, because it can, the battery can store solar power that's generated very cheaply when solar production is at, you know, going at full tilt. And then when the sun goes down, it can discharge that power and make it so that, it can provide power for longer by discharging the batteries. And batteries have become significantly more cost effective and cheaper to build in the last several years. So it seems pretty reflective of other similar projects we've seen across the country.
When we've talked about renewable energy in the past, concerns have been raised about reliability. And do the battery packs like these massive battery packs, help address the issues of reliability, Catherine?
They do help address the issues of reliability, yes. At this juncture, that most batteries that you're seeing added to projects like this will discharge power for about 4 hours. This technology is generally you can call it a 4-hour lithium ion solution. And that's helpful, right? I mean, that's helpful because when you consider the fact that a lot of times in many regions across the United States, you see power demand peak in the evening hours as, you know, people are getting home from work, or there's simply more people in the household using electricity. And that of course is when you begin to see solar power production decline. So if you can use batteries to help carry you through that period, that does a lot to help reliability concerns that kind of come with the fact that this production profile changes throughout the day. It's not the only solution that's needed, but it's definitely helpful.
Catherine Blunt from the Wall Street Journal joining us. And back in December, you found that companies were on track to add a record number of these battery installations across the country. Why is such a peak in interest? What is it about these battery packs right now?
Yeah, so there's a number of different factors at play. For one, it's simply that costs to install, to build and install these batteries have fallen precipitously over the past decade or so. And so it's just made it so it's just not as expensive to do so as it was even just a few years ago. And that's a big thing. It's worth keeping in mind too, that renewable generation, both in the form of solar power as we're discussing, as well as wind, are some of the cheapest forms of power generation out there. So a lot of this is, it's driven by the market. But then there's an additional layer, of course, in which in Wisconsin and other states, there are very ambitious goals to significantly reduce carbon reductions that come from the grid by adding more renewable energy generation, perhaps with the intent to, you know, eliminate those emissions in the next, you know, few decades. Yeah, 2050 is a common goal in Wisconsin and elsewhere. So in order to make that happen, batteries are a key piece of the puzzle to ensure reliability, as you mentioned earlier.
Catherine Blunt, renewable energy and utilities reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And what questions do you have about batteries being used in our energy grid? And should the U.S. transition to some more renewable energy sources? 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation. And Catherine, what share of our grid is renewable energy now and battery storage compared to our fossil fuel usage?
Yeah, so renewables make up a fairly sizable let me put it this way. Carbon-free electricity generation makes up a pretty substantial portion of our power generation mix at this moment. And when I say that, that includes hydroelectric power, which, a lot of that, of course, was built out decades ago. But, combined with wind and solar power, it's become, I think, at least for a very long time, and I believe this is still the case today, really second only to natural gas in terms of prevalence, and closely followed by nuclear power, and then coal, which has been on the decline for some time. So, but a big reason for that, a big reason why I'll say carbon-free generation has eclipsed nuclear is just due to the very significant additions of wind and solar over the past several years. You don't see any large additions in hydroelectric facilities. So that's the reason why you kind of got pushed over that threshold. But yes, it's natural gas is still the dominant form of power generation, but wind and solar have become very significant in their own right.
This utility-scale solar power plant going up in Kenosha County would be the first of its kind in the state of Wisconsin. But Catherine, give us some perspective nationwide and even around the globe. Where are we seeing this sort of development? Which states are developing battery facilities the fastest?
California is a big leader in this space, and there's of course California has been a leader in adding renewable energy, since the start of the century. And so now they're at a really critical juncture because there have been very rapid additions of wind and solar power over the last couple of decades, and they're also planning to retire the last nuclear power plant in the state, as well as several natural gas fired plants in the next several years. And so on top of that, the state simply needs more power generation in general to meet its very ambitious carbon reduction goals. So it is working, the Public Utility Commission, the counterpart in that state, recently approved a really large procurement order in which all of the utilities and other power providers throughout the state have to contract for a really significant amount of battery storage over just the next couple of years, in part to help offset the effect of those plant closures. And those plants, are sources of electricity that can supply power at all times of day. And so you're challenged in that you need to have power supply, to available during those hours, which is where battery storage comes in. Solar alone, of course, can't supply it, nor can wind.
Let's go to your questions now at 1-800-642-1234, where Bill is standing by and done. Bill, you're on the air with Catherine Blunt from the Wall Street Journal.
Hey, good morning. Hey, what's the life expectancy of these batteries? They're not exactly, the way they're mined and everything to get the lithium out, they're not exactly green,
Well, let's ask Catherine. 110-megawatt battery pack or plant is what's planned for Kenosha County in the town of Paris. How long would we expect that to store our electricity, Catherine?
Yeah, so I mean, these are long-term projects, and can be used over the course of many years. There does reach a point in which, I mean, it certainly varies by project and by size, but of course, listeners, Bill, you raise a great point. There have long been supply chain concerns as it relates to lithium-ion batteries, and there kind of does reach a point in which they reach an end of life cycle, and that needs to be addressed in terms of how you kind of either reuse or recycle or do something else with the components.
Is the lifespan dependent on its usage, like, the batteries that we use?
In some ways, yes, it is. How often is it discharged? How is it? Yeah, how often does it charge and discharge, essentially?
Catherine Blunt joining us, renewable energy and utilities reporter for the Wall Street Journal, taking your calls this morning at 1-800-642-1234. As the first of its kind utility scale solar plant goes up in Kenosha County beginning this spring. Actually, they're leveling the ground as we speak, and as many as 750,000 solar panels expected from the original plan to be powering part of southern Wisconsin. What questions do you have about this utility scale solar plant? 1-800-642-1234. 604-280-6421234. Our conversation with Catherine Blunt continues. I'm Lee Rayburn, and you are listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. As mentioned, the grading and groundwork has begun in the construction of Wisconsin's first utility-scale solar power plant. This is The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and according to the Wisconsin State Journal, the installation of up to 750,000 solar panels is scheduled to begin later this spring. Some consumer advocates say the utility companies failed to prove any benefit to ratepayers and raised some concerns about reliability. What would your concerns be about costs, opportunity costs, and the future of energy in our environment? Taking your calls at 1-800-642-1234, your emails at ideas@wpr.org, with our guest, Catherine Blunt, renewable energy and utilities reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Let's go to Andrew in Dousman this morning with a question. Andrew, you're on the air.
Hi, good morning.
Morning.
So my one concern would be going to a significant or relying on solar and wind for a significant portion of our electricity needs. My concern would be the reliability, because you look at California, as you mentioned, they have a significant amount of renewable energy or carbon-free energy that they rely upon, and they regularly have rolling blackouts. And then I look down to Texas just two winters ago, where they had a smaller portion of electrical energy supplied by wind and solar, and they had people dying because they couldn't get heat into their houses and they weren't prepared with more reliable sources of coal-based or fossil fuel-based. So my concern would be that when the electrical grid goes down because we can't supply people due to wind or solar, it comes at a high cost, and it can cost people their lives. So that would be my main concern.
Andrew, thank you. Catherine, could we see a situation like we saw in Texas a few years ago here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, so there's a couple of interesting points that Andrew, you make some excellent points. Both Texas and California have absolutely faced their challenges over the last couple of years. In Texas, So Texas has a very interesting power market design, and I won't get too much into the details of that, but, alongside this market design, there was not a requirement for power producers across the board to winterize their generation facilities. Now, in Texas, it doesn't get cold like it does in Wisconsin. In Wisconsin, of course, those that are producing power are prepared to operate in colder temperatures like you saw in Texas. It was just so anomalous, that kind of freeze in Texas. I mean, just the generators were not prepared, and it was failure. It was across the board. Like, you did see at different times in that week a decline in wind and solar power, but there was also an issue with the nuclear plant. There was issues with coal plants. I mean, coal stockpiles just froze. And there was also a very significant issue with natural gas production throughout the state, because natural gas producers also hadn't been required to winterize and therefore couldn't get the fuel supply to the power plants, even those that could function. So I would say that there's not a great risk of that same sort of disaster occurring in Wisconsin, which has been prepared for this kind of weather for an extremely long time.
Let's go to William now, who's on his way to Toma this morning. William, you're on the air with Catherine Blunt from the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, my question is, was there a study done on the carbon footprint, even over a specific amount of time, comparing geothermal electric production versus this solar power plant?
Unfortunately, I don't know the answer to that specifically. It certainly would be interesting to see if this particular development site lent itself to that, lent itself to geothermal. That would come with higher costs. Geothermal is not necessarily, especially at scale, as perhaps on like a per megawatt hour basis, as cost competitive as solar plus storage, I would imagine. But I'm certain that there was a study done that probably analyzed other options.
What would have a lower carbon impact, geothermal or solar? Generally,
a lower carbon impact. I'm not quite sure. Both have the potential to, you know, reduce, both are lower carbon options than other options.
Let's go to Jeff in Delafield next. Jeff, you're on the air with Catherine Blunt from the Wall Street Journal.
Yes, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. How many acres does this new utility scale solar facility utilize, and how many acres of Wisconsin would have to be devoted to solar in order to produce, you know, to replace our dependence on coal, natural gas? And my concern is that we're using land that could be used for, in other ways, forestry, native grasslands, which also absorb carbon, or possibly smart grazing, or are we using farmland that, as food prices continue to skyrocket, are we using farmland that could be used to alleviate those food costs? Thank you.
The story from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel cites a 1,500-acre footprint for about 750,000 solar panels. And I know, Catherine, you're not don't know the specifics of these, so I'll cite this from the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. But in general, when we're talking about the footprint of solar plants, what's some of the considerations, especially when we're considering the environment and other potential uses for that property?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I will say, in general, in talking to developers across the country, you know, especially in certain regions, you know, especially in, for example, you know, in the West, where there's, you know, a lot of highly productive sites for renewable energy have already been developed. Certainly there's a bit of a land crunch here, and making sure that the land is used well, used responsibly, and not, you know, encroaching upon encroaching upon other uses. You know, of course, the listener mentions agriculture, of course, is very significant, and these, you know, selling areas for livestock. I will say that, you know, over the last number of years, this technology has become, it's just, you know, more productive per unit. So perhaps you don't need as many panels covering the same amount of square acreage, or, you know, a single turbine is so much larger than it used to be, a wind turbine, so maybe you don't need quite as many. So the land use consideration has become a little bit less of a concern, but it is still certainly a very legitimate concern that's going to need to be carefully managed in pretty much every state.
Continue with your questions now with Prescott, who's calling us from Northern Illinois. Prescott, you're on with Catherine Blunt from the Wall Street Journal.
Hi, Catherine. Thanks for taking my call this morning. I'd like to talk about how this whole green movement has been, I think, more propelled by green guilt and not so much by, facts and science so much. I mean, we have typically a 20-year lifespan out of wind turbines, and then we have to break those down, and those are mostly made of epoxies and bulk wood, and then broken down and thrown back into the landfill. And they're kind of showing that the environmental impact is really not good for wind turbines, and I kind of like to hear your opinion on that, and also maybe hear your opinion about nuclear energy as a better form and a form of energy that can provide us.
Prescott, I appreciate it, and we're running out of time here, but the power of nuclear potential and as well the downside or the ungreen of green energy, Catherine.
Sure. So, nuclear energy is pretty amazing in that it provides carbon-free electricity around the clock. It has historically been, at the size that we've seen, some of the plants we've seen, that's historically been very expensive. There's only one nuclear plant under construction in the United States, in Georgia. It's suffered from significant cost overruns. And in general, you know, there's been public concern broadly about, what to do with nuclear waste. And it's a very safe industry. It's very well managed, but it has been hard to build that kind of generation in the United States. We might begin to build some smaller modular reactors going forward to help solve for some of the reliability issues that listeners have been raising. We may see that. In terms of large scale generation, I don't think we're going to see much more of that going forward. And the cost because these plants, you know, were very significant and costly to build, generally the electricity that they produce is more costly as a result, and it's not an especially competitive form of generation. Now, we were also discussing earlier, I mean, take, for example, the lithium ion battery. I mean, you can, there are similar concerns associated with production of panels and turbines and how they're disposed of. But, you know, the question at hand here is really reducing reducing carbon emissions that could add to, you know, exacerbate climate change over time. And certainly everything has a cost.
Right.
But
and
that's
Catherine,
where we're going with this.
I appreciate it. And we're just out of time. But it was looking at a carbon neutral future. And there's certainly more questions to be had. Catherine Blunt, thank you for answering ours this morning.
Thank you so much for having me. Enjoyed the conversation.
Catherine Blunt's the Renewable and Energy Utilities Reporter for the Wall Street Journal. Up next, news, then we hear from the director of the UW La Crosse School Psychology Program about a state shortage of school psychologists. You're listening to The Morning Show. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn. And coming up in a few minutes, Wisconsin's shortage of school psychologists and the new UW La Crosse program intended to address it. But first, the COVID-19 pandemic has accelerated long-term college enrollment declines as well as worker shortages in Wisconsin. As higher education and industry adapt, they're refining the traditional pipeline from high school to college, as Rich Kramer reports.
On a Friday afternoon, Random Lake High School's gymnasium is full of students moving through a sea of folding tables. More than 50 employers from industries like manufacturing, healthcare, and hospitality are there to talk about their post-graduation options. Dominic Montello is checking out employers. After making good money at a summer job, taking on debt for college doesn't sound that appealing.
I want to get right into the workforce, make money, as much money as I can.
Kelly Weibelhaus is manning a table for Career Foods, which manufactures popular soda and energy drink brands. She says the company is looking for students just like Dominic to go through the co-op course they developed with the high school. It offers paid, part-time work for seniors that can lead to a post-graduation job.
So why not put them in the workforce, see what they like, and then if they like that, have a company pay for their college.
Career Foods, like many companies, offers tuition reimbursement as part of its benefits package. The pandemic and low unemployment rates have added to long-term enrollment declines at two-year campuses in the state. Over the past decade, enrollment has fallen by 34% at state technical colleges and nearly 57% at two-year University of Wisconsin system campuses. Random Lake District Administrator Michael Trimberger is a co-founder of the nonprofit Inspire Sheboygan County, which acts as a bridge between businesses and regional high schools developing work-based curriculum. He says exposing kids to jobs before graduation makes more sense than having them choose a path while taking on student loan debt.
As we deconstruct the old narrative, the new narrative should be figure out what you want to do, explore what you want to do, and when you know, then skill yourself up through education and get to the level that you want to be able to really define what your success is.
Colleges and universities have long been partnering with high schools. The number of kids taking dual enrollment courses where students work toward associate's degrees has skyrocketed in recent years. At the same time, the percentage of high school grads, particularly young men, going straight to college is declining. Recent Plymouth High School graduate A.J. Klug says he felt lost near the end of his high school career. He thought about college but was deterred by the prospect of taking on lots of student loan debt. Instead, he signed up for an 80-hour co-op with local car dealership Van Horn Automotive and felt at home working alongside master mechanics.
And I got into the shop and I said to myself, this is actually something that I enjoy doing. You know, I found something. I don't have to, you know, worry about it so much anymore.
Klug is still working for the dealership and taking tech college classes toward a certification. Van Horn offered an apprenticeship program with $6,500 in scholarships for tools and tuition. Klug expects to finish his certificate without any debt. As businesses make inroads to high schools, the traditional pipeline from high school to college is changing. Wisconsin Technical College President Morna Foy says flexibility is more important than ever.
I think the career pathway, this idea that there are many entry and exit points, is really a reflection on the most significant change in higher ed and is now being driven by what students and employers through their employees need.
Projections show the number of people hitting retirement age in many states will quickly outpace the number of working-age adults. What's been dubbed the silver tsunami is likely to drive more high school recruitment by businesses and even greater changes for colleges. Rich Kramer, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Now, taking care of our kids. We cannot talk about the mental well-being of our children without talking about access to mental health care. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network, and a new online program at UW-La Crosse is set to address a shortage of school psychologists, especially in more rural districts, by offering accreditation to educators who are already in the schools. However, many of these same schools are facing shortages of teachers themselves. So what's best for our kids, and how can we best get them what they need? You tell me this morning at 1-800-642-1234. Parents and students alike, speak up or email us ideas@WPR.org. Our guest is Robert Dixon. He's an associate professor at UW-La Crosse and the director of the school psychology program. Rob, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
So this is a problem in our rural districts and across the state. But as I understand it, this program that you are getting underway at UW-La Crosse is a one of a kind in its state and one of only three across the country right now. What is it that makes this program special?
Well, I think what it is really trying to extend the walls of the university to go beyond our traditional brick and mortar program to reach those individuals that are landlocked, so to speak, in rural areas that want to pursue a degree in school psychology and provide services to the students that they are servicing already as teachers or administrators or specialists. And this really allows them to do that without picking up their family and heading down to UW-La Crosse or another brick and mortar school.
Can it, what about in terms of scheduling? Time would be at a premium for teachers, I would imagine.
Absolutely. So we built the program with the thought of teachers in mind or professionals in mind. And that is, we're going to do one class at a time as compared to our five classes that we do in a semester. And each class will be about 7 weeks long, and they'll take one after the other through the program. They'll complete all of their coursework after 3 years. And then their fourth year will be an internship where they can be a school psychologist in their district.
So when will the first students begin classes?
This July.
This July. Is enrollment open as we speak, Rob?
Enrollment is open. The applications, we're accepting them right now. We have a number of people that are interested in submitting things. And we are going to do a first review at the end of this month or April 1st, and then continue to accept applications until we fill the program.
So then when would your first graduating class be active as school psychologists in our workforce?
They would be active August of 2025.
What are we going to do in the meantime?
Well, we can't solve this problem overnight. This has been a problem that's been evolving over time. And you mentioned Wisconsin being a shortage state, which is absolutely true. But there are shortages across the nation. And it's really something that's been concerning the field of school psychology for probably five, almost 10 years now. And we really need to do something different to address the problem, because our current solution of what we're doing is not closing that gap.
What's the role of a school psychologist in the classroom, inside the schools, and maybe even beyond? What does a school psychologist do?
It's a great question. I see it as being three main roles. The first would be to assess kids with a potential disability and to lead some of the multidisciplinary team to decide whether there's a disability for that particular individual. The second would be to consult with teachers in the classroom. Obviously, there's children with different needs, and the teacher is designed or working to make the classroom the best place possible. But school psychologists can help with both classroom management or classroom implementation of different programs, as well as looking at individual students to help them better succeed in the classroom. And the last is to do direct interventions for mental health, either by doing large group types of activities or even individual activities. And we're seeing this need or this role for the mental health piece increasing as we're going along in the different years. I mean, I've been a practitioner for 20 years, and I've really seen in the last few years the mental health needs of the community, as well as the desire to hire school psychologists, just really exploding at this point.
We're talking about the shortage of school psychologists in Wisconsin with Rob Dixon. He's an associate professor at UW-La Crosse and the director of the university's school psychology program. Does your child go to a school that's short-staffed, and how is it affecting their learning? How about their mental health? And what should the legislature do, if anything, to address workforce shortages in our schools? Tell us, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation, or email ideas at WPR.org. The National Association of School Psychologists, Rob, recommends that schools should have one school psychologist for every 500 students. Now, a shortage in Wisconsin suggests that's not the case, but what's the end result for the kids if we don't meet that bare minimum of a threshold? What do we see as a result?
Well, as a result, we tend to see, like, if a school psychologist, I mentioned those three roles. Mm-hmm. And so if I'm a school psychologist and I'm serving a district and have more students than what the recommendation is, then my role is restricted to what the school needs the most, which tends to be assessment of students for disabilities, because that's a role that nobody else can play. And that means that the consultation time that I would have with teachers would be limited. The intervention time that I would have with students would also be limited. And that creates a problem in the sense that students don't get everything that they possibly could get through the services that a school psych could provide. And even for a mental health professional, counselors, social workers, I mean, there's more problems in the schools right now than any one profession can take care of. But school psychologists are the focus of where I'm coming from.
Rob Dixon, our guest. Let's go to your calls now. John in Westby joins us. John, you're on with Rob Dixon, who is the UW-La Crosse director of the school psychology program.
Yeah, thanks for getting me on. A great topic. I guess this is indicative, at least for me, of a deeper issue, and that is our society. We say we value our children, but yet you look at our funding locally, nationally, and statewide, we don't. We devalue our children. And also must preface this, I have two daughters who are school social workers and one who's a school psychologist. But you know, as a society, we say kids are so important, but you look at funding compared to everything else, and they really aren't. And I think this is an inconvenient truth that we have to deal with.
Hey, if I can ask, John, why do your kids do what they do? Why is your daughter a school psychologist?
I don't know. They love it, and they're good with kids, but they're also saddled with debt.
So it's not for the salary. It's for the psychic income.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, her debt load is, you know, doesn't say, but it's about $90,000, and you don't get a lot of money in the school district. And thank God they're in Minnesota where they like people. You
know, that's I don't know what that means, John, but
what it means is, you know, we've defunded our schools. When you look at the rising of everything in our state, and you go back to the Walker administration.
Oh, in Wisconsin, we've devalued our schools.
Absolutely. I mean, look at the salary level between across the Mississippi, and it's staggering, the amount. And actually, you look the staggering amount, the difference between Westby and La Crosse. I mean, it's tens of thousands of dollars difference.
John, I appreciate the perspective, and I want to ask our guest, Rob Dixon, here why he sees a shortage in school psychologists across Wisconsin. Is money part of the problem?
Not from what I can see. Our students do fairly well right out of the gate as far as salaries are concerned. And, you know, there are some programs federally as well as, federally predominantly that does forgive debt if you're working with disabled populations. And so being a school psychologist, that tends to fit right in there. And these programs are evolving and changing over time. And so you really have to pay attention to what's out there in order to take advantage of some of the opportunities that are out there.
So if it's not the money, where is this shortage of school psychologists in Wisconsin coming from as you see it?
I see there's two issues that are really impacting the field. One is our special ed laws were enacted about 50 years ago. And so a lot of the school psychologists that came on board are getting gray and older and retiring, and that's a great thing. And so that's leaving a shortage. The other piece that's impacting that is that the school psychs that are in the buildings are moving up into different system level roles. We have people becoming principals. We have the RTI Center in Wisconsin that's hires a number of school psychologists in coaching positions or systemic intervention positions to help school districts move things forward. And these individuals are just impacting more, more schools and more kids. And that's a great thing. But these two things, I think, do impact the number of school psychs that are in the field. And what I've seen over the past 20 years that I've been a director, it used to be the best time to be a, to find a school psych position was in August, because that's when the schools figured out their budgets and they could figure out what their staffing patterns are. I run a WSPA, Wisconsin School Psych Association, the job fair, and we have to run that in February because that's when districts are looking for individuals. And I have my entire class by the end of March here already signed contracts for the fall, and it's March 29th.
Wow.
So it is really, they're in demand, and schools want them. There's just not enough of them that are being graduated from programs, and that's the biggest concern.
And that's why the new program's being launched at UW-La Crosse with our guest, Rob Dixon. He is the director of the school psychology program there, and our conversation continues with you along as well at 1-800-642-1234. I'm Lee Rayburn. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's the Morning Show on the Ideas Network. I'm Lee Rayburn, and for Kate Archer Kent. And in January, Kate talked to Linda Hall, director of Wisconsin's Office of Children's Mental Health, and she laid out the problem prior to the pandemic succinctly.
The data in our 2021 report, which actually is data that's primarily before the pandemic, shows that our kids are struggling more with anxiety and depression, with difficulty making and maintaining relationships, and difficulty in feeling like they belong at school and in the community.
Anecdotally, anyway, nothing about the pandemic has made any of that any better. Our guest is here with one potential opportunity to work towards a solution. What questions do you have about offering our educators the opportunity to become school psychologists? 1-800 and professionals as well, 1-800-642-1234 to join our conversation with our guest, Robert Dixon, associate professor at UW-La Crosse and the director of the school psychology program. And Rob, how has the pandemic impacted the need for school psychologists?
Well, I just think it's accentuated the need for mental health services for all kids. I mean, the prior comment that you laid out is really perfect. The idea of some of that anxiety and depression coming out in kids, social anxiety, I see that as being absolutely true and critical for the functioning of kids. And if we want our kids to achieve in school, we have to think about the whole child, and that includes the mental health of them. And so I'm right there with you as far as the concerns that were laid out.
So David from Milwaukee called in quickly just to say that this is a wonderful initiative taking place. He says it is well-timed and very much needed. Let's go to Sarah, who joins us from Libertyville, Illinois this morning. Sarah, you're on with Rob Dixon.
Good morning. I'm a current substitute teacher. I used to be a full-time teacher, and I work in high-need schools, and I've just never, you know, we've never had enough social workers. Most of the places I've worked, like, I barely knew who the psychologist was because she was never there. And because she worked in multiple schools. But I worked in one district a couple years ago where the school had gone on strike, and one of their issues was social worker and psychologist staffing. And they were on strike for 6 weeks. They had to bring in a mediator, and finally they basically got what they needed. And so when I worked in this school, we had 450 really high need kids. We had 1.5 social workers and a school psychologist. And I just can't tell you how great it was to know there was someone that I could send the kids to when they had issues, because otherwise it was just impossible. And I just, like, the trauma that was going on in these, with these kids, where there was nothing to do about it. I mean, I had 25 kids. It was like two. I'm not a garment. Anyway, so thank you very, very much.
Sarah, thank you for that perspective. And Rob, let's reiterate this program once again at the UW-La Crosse. You said that the enrollment is now open. This is online and it's asynchronous, and it's an opportunity for professionals to enter the field of school psychology. And it sounds, you know, it sounds rewarding. But it also sounds like it's going to take a while before we get new school psychologists into this program or through this program and into the schools. How do we get started on this? Where can we find out more?
So you can find out more on the UW La Crosse website. And just want to thank the caller for identifying the mental health needs of the kids. That's why we're doing this. And unfortunately, we can't solve this problem yesterday. It does take some time to get people up to speed. And it's a 70 or a 60 credit master's and education specialist degree. So it's just below the doctorate. And so it's a substantial amount of time commitment for individuals. Mm-hmm. And a substantial amount of learning. It's not something that they've learned a lot through their programs that they've taken already. So it's brand new classes, brand new information. And we're looking forward to the incredible response we've had across the state and being able to provide this open door for teachers and school professionals to enter through it and become school psychologists.
Well, and the other aspect that Sarah brought up that may be missed in talking about the mental health and mental health care access to our kids is also the power of school psychologists, social workers for the teacher in the classroom. Teachers have to wear a lot of hats. They have to, have their own office supplies, but I can't imagine what it would be like to have the psychological support that you need when you need it.
So I guess there's two types of psychological support that school psychologists do. And this was true for me all the way through. There's a support that we can certainly offer the students through individual or group means. But I think teachers come down to my office frequently just to look for support and encouragement and just to be able to talk about how it's impacting them. I mean, one of the things that we haven't talked about too much is just, the shortage of teachers, burnout, the pandemic that's impacted them as well. I mean, those are all true as well. And so a school psychologist potentially could expand their role beyond what maybe a school has right now and include teachers as one of the people that they can kind of attend to. Not that we're going to be the therapist for all teachers, but we can certainly be that helpful ear, as well as if somebody is really impacted by the situation, be a very good conduit to get them the help that they need.
You've worked as a school psychologist for more than 30 years, Rob. What's the most significant change you've seen over the last three decades?
Easily, it's the mental health piece. When I started as a school psychologist back in the late 80s, I almost had to fight to do mental health services with kids. Not fight like you would think, just kind of really argue and advocate for kids that they needed some support that way. And I was in the schools 2019, just before the pandemic hit. And the principal at that time said, I'm not really interested in doing a lot of testing or a lot of consulting. We'll do that on the fly, but it's the mental health needs of the kids that we really need to be taken care of. And so that is almost a 180 degree switch from where I started from.
Rob, very much appreciate you joining us this morning. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity.
Robert Dixon is associate professor at UW La Crosse, where he is the director of the school psychology program. And that online and asynchronous master's and education specialist program is available for school psychologists. That enrollment is open now. Just ahead, the election for Milwaukee's next mayor, a week away. So we're talking to the candidates this week to give you one last opportunity to get your questions answered directly by them. That's next. I'm Lee Rayburn in for Kate Archer Kent. And you're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.